On décodait la mer, là-bas sur le ciel clair, il existe une cité
Welcome to the sixth podcast from my hometown now of Andailles, France. And the lovely music in the background is by Josephine Baker. And this song is actually done by her back in 1953, the exact year that is featured in this podcast. 1953 brings Hemingway back to Andailles and to the famous Basque region of southwest France and northwest Spain. Andailles is a beach town, and Hemingway loved Andailles so much that this is his sixth time coming back. The first five podcasts explained each of his trips here, and this, the sixth broadcast, is his last trip if one doesn't count a day he drove through later in 1959. But he didn't spend any evenings here, so for all intents and purposes, this is his real last substantial visit to Andailles. Now, let's set the table here for Andailles as a destination for Hemingway. He came here in 1925 with his first wife, Hadley, where he was writing The Sun Also Rises. He came here in 1927 with his new second wife, Pauline, where he was putting, he was beginning to write and have some ideas for A Farewell to Arms. But in 1929, he came back solo, where he was struggling to finish A Farewell to Arms. And if you recall the finish to this wonderful story, he must have had 50 different endings before he finally settled on the one where he had the famous heroine. I won't tell you how the story ended in case you haven't read it. But in 1931, he returns with Pauline. And in 1933, he came back at the end of August for only a few days. And this would be his last trip to Andailles until now, 1953. Now, what kind of mood was Ernest in 1953? Well, let's just talk a bit about 1952 and what happened to him. In 1952, for maybe the only time that he lived in Cuba, he and Mary had spent the whole year of 1952 in Cuba. And the great news he got in 1952 is he published The Old Man and the Sea in September. It was a monumental event because Hemingway was coming off a defeat, like a heavyweight champion doing a boxing match. He came back from having written a book called Across the River and Into the Trees, and it was penned by almost every critic as being Hemingway's, probably his worst novel. And one could criticize a few of his other works, like the play he had written called The Fifth Column, or the parody he had written about a former friend named Sherwood Anderson called The Torrents of Spring, way back in 1925. But here it is, 1952, and he'd finished publishing The Old Man and the Sea, and he was ecstatic because it got rave reviews. In fact, it got such good reviews that in 1953, on May 4, he learned that he won the Pulitzer Prize for this great book. And a little side note, the money he won from the Pulitzer Prize, he gave to his oldest son, John, who he had had with Hadley back in 1923. And now Hemingway's feeling good. He's got a lot of money. He got a $25,000 royalty check for giving the rights to a guy named Leland Hayward to do the movie about The Old Man and the Sea. He got another $25,000 for agreeing to be a consultant on that movie to provide footage of catching sharks off the Pilar in the Caribbean and also catching big marlin in Peru. Now, Hemingway's flush with cash then. He's got 50 grand in his pocket. So he's flipping a coin to son John by giving him all the winnings from what he called the pullover prize. Instead of the Pulitzer, he would often give funny names, and he called the Pulitzer the pullover prize. And he would even call the Nobel Prize the Ig Nobel Prize. Well, here we are on June 24 of 1953. He and Mary board the SS Flandre for Le Havre, France. And Le Havre, France is on the very western coast of France, not too far from Normandy. And to get an idea of what it was like to travel with Hemingway and his fourth wife, Mary, back in 1924, allow me to read you a brief passage from Michael Reynolds' biography. This biography is from the book The 1930s Through the Final Years. He writes, "On June 24, Ernest and Mary, fortified with 593 pounds of necessities stuffed into 24 pieces of luggage, settled down into their double suite on the SS Flandre, bound for Le Havre, where Gianfranco Ivancic met them at the customs house. Awaiting their arrival was a rented Lancia car and an Italian undertaker come chauffeur named Adamo. Adamo somehow tied down all the excess luggage on top of the car." That's really 593 pounds. "The first stop was the Ritz Hotel in Paris, to store what they didn't need for Spain, and after that they were going to East Africa. But immediately after leaving Paris, they drove through Rambouillet to Chartres to remember the last time Ernest had prayed here in 1944. On down the Loire Valley they drove, Ernest in the front seat, Mary and Gianfranco in the back, with the coats, cameras, maps, guidebooks, radio, bottled water, wine, and local papers. Turning south under gray clouds, they eventually arrived at Hotel Escola Duna in Andai, bringing back memories of long ago summers on the same beach with Hadley, and then with Pauline, staying in modest oceanfront hotels when a dollar was worth 25 francs, which almost paid for one room." All right, thank you, Michael Reynolds, for that passage. So the question is, did they arrive on July 3 or July 6? Or what exact date? Well, a guy named Brewster Chamberlain has written that they arrived and passed through to the Spanish border on July 3, but I think, yes, it's Reynolds who has them coming through Spain on July 6. Nowhere have I been able to find how many nights Mary and Ernest spent here. It had to be at least one night, probably two, just because I'm guessing Ernest wanted to show Mary where he had stayed back in the 1920s and 30s. But in any case, Ernest was glad to be back. He was ecstatic. But it's somewhat funny about Ernest's return because he had some trepidation that he might not be welcomed here. Because if you remember, he came here back in 1937 and 1938 when he was a journalist for the North American Newspaper Alliance, and he was covering the Spanish Civil War. And as a journalist, he was not supposed to take sides, but it wasn't long before Ernest knew that he had to side with the Republicans, because the Republicans were fighting for the common man to defeat the people who were trying to take over power undemocratically. Now, most Americans don't know many details about the Spanish Civil War, but let it just be said that Stalin, being a leftist communist, was backing the Republican movement, which Ernest threw his hat in the ring for. But and looking back, that's probably a good thing that Ernest did, because who was on the other side of the fence? It was the fascists, led by Franco of Spain, who was an ally of Hitler, and the fascists in Italy. So Ernest was here as a neutral journalist, but he threw his hat in the ring with the Republicans. And so Franco, who ultimately won and took power in France as a fascist dictator, was no friend of Hemingway. And as a result, Hemingway wasn't sure if he would be welcomed at the border. The good news was, not only did the border guards recognize him, but they took off their hats to him and even asked for autographs. So that Ernest was so happy to be given a reception as a famous writer, even though he was not a friend of the government in power. Now, in closing, I would like to say that this part of Ernest's life was so good in many respects, but Hemingway also was very much struggling with alcohol. He was drinking copious amounts of alcohol, and let me just give you an idea of what he was consuming. Right after he came to Ondye, he went on a second safari to Eastern Africa, to the country of Kenya, and he set sail from the French Riviera and down through the channel in Egypt, and he went down to Mombasa, Kenya, where he disembarked and began his 1953-1954 safari. But to get an idea of how much he was drinking then, let me read you something that comes from one of Hemingway's biographers. He said that during the late summer of 1953, which Hemingway spent in East Africa, he was drinking two or three bottles of liquor a day, as well as wine with meals. Dennis Safiro, a ranger with the Kenya Game Department, has testified that, quote, he was drunk the whole time, unquote, although he seldom showed it. He just became merrier, more lovable, more bullshitty. Without drink, he was a morose, silent, and depressed man. That actually comes from Glenn's book, page 570, and some of this also comes from Mary Dearborn's book. That his liver was in trouble and had been rudely brought to Hemingway's attention by the terrible attack of cirrhotic pain he suffered in Paris in January 1938, and liver-related problems plagued him throughout the final phase of his life. So Hemingway was drinking a lot during the safari, and in fact, another piece of this is from Jeffrey Myers, his book. Hemingway had aged and was drinking heavily, which made it difficult to shoot accurately, and he may have been afraid of not living up to his heroic image in front of the professional photographer Earl Thiessen, who was having problems getting the pictures he needed for Life magazine. And one other quote here about his drinking. He may or may not have been drinking, but he fell out of a Land Rover during a sharp curve, and he cut his face, bruised his right side, he sprained his shoulder, and that didn't help his hunting either. So this is all 1953, everybody, and so Hemingway, yes, he was living a larger-than-life life. He was going on a safari. He was returning to the land that he loved, Spain. He came back to Ondye for the sixth time. This is how much he loved Ondye, and he was heading for a bullfight, a feria, in San Sebastian, which is literally a 30-minute train ride from here. It's $5.50, actually €5.50, about $7 for a round-trip ticket, train ticket, from here in Ondye to San Sebastian. So with that, folks, I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Let's return again to end this podcast with a little of the great music from Josephine Baker. Au revoir and à bientôt.